Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 134, The Mysterious and the Communal, part 6, the conclusion part of this series. God is Red, a Native View on Religion by Vine Deloria Jr. and published by Fulcrum. From what little I know, Fulcrum continues today to publish a lot of Native authors. I was going to try to find some information about Deloria to recite, but decided to just give a thanks to him and to say how important it is to, I guess, for whatever one's people's looking to sort of clarify things for others, what an important role that plays, and what a fine example he gives for anyone who's trying to convey their views to others. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Three chapters to go. This is chapter 15, The Aboriginal World and Christian History. A few paragraphs into the chapter. This is a kind of, made the note, a turning point. The reaction of the Christian nations to the discovery of the New World and its potential riches was one of unmitigated greed. Having been repulsed by the Muslims in their efforts to subjugate the Near East, and nearly prostrated after the wars to establish the divine right monarchies, the kings of Europe badly needed an inexhaustible source of income to maintain themselves. Visualizing a steady stream of wealth from the Indies, which would allow them to avoid giving political rights and economic benefits to the rising commercial classes in return for financial support to the crown, the heads of the European states saw in the New World the only hope of maintaining themselves. The Christian church was also eager to exploit the new lands, its political power beginning to wane with the rise of strong European political leaders. The Christian church saw a means of directing the invasion of the new lands by placing its imprimatur on exploitation, in effect taking a percentage of the loot in return for blessing the enterprise. In 1493, Pope Alexander VI issued his Inter Cetera Bull, which laid down the basic Christian attitude toward the New World. Quote, among other works, well pleasing to the divine majesty and cherished to our heart, this assuredly ranks highest, that in our times, especially the Catholic faith and the Christian religion, be exalted and everywhere increased and spread, that the health of souls be cared for, and that barbarous nations be overthrown and brought to the faith itself. And that's, as we've discussed, the doctrine of Christian discovery, and one of the roots of the troubles even unto today. And that he makes note of, sometimes, you know, growing up with certain education, and then these things are mind-changing. Exploration and colonization continue. The debate expanded about the native peoples and their rights. The only available philosophical system purporting to explain the world of daily events was that of Aristotle, who had once divided mankind into men and slaves. The anti-Indian theologians relied heavily upon Aristotelian thinking to support their thesis that natives could be enslaved. So you get these various, as he writes, justifying the exploitation and conquest, these various historical citations and such like. The first articulation of the Christian attitude toward the native peoples and their rights came in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, in which the U.S. Congress proclaimed that it would never take the Indians' lands except in just wars. As it turned out, there were no just wars, and the lands were systematically taken. As late as World War I, nations were being given to dominate European nations as League of Nations mandates and protectorates. Colonialism has still not vanished. It now shows itself as the American political crusade for a new world order, or as the operational results of the giant supranational corporations of Western peoples. Western corporate imperialism so dominates the world scene, it is easy to overlook Japan's taking sovereignty over a few islands. The way colonialism morphs is akin to probably the next book in the show, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, which shows how racism morphs. When Canada and Australia achieved independence from the British Crown, they allegedly stepped into the shoes of Queen Elizabeth II insofar as the natives of the lands were concerned. Talking about the U.S. giving more rights to natives than Canadian Indians, and the Aborigines of Australia are in worse shape because they are by definition without rights. They cannot enter the courts of that land to defend their rights to lands on which they have lived for thousands of years. Australia claims a legal right to the lands of the continent as derived from Great Britain, while denying the Australian Aborigines the right to demand from the Australian government the protection in land occupancy such a derived title implies. So he goes on to cover Sweden, Lapland, you know, the worldly scope, and his law background really adds is fascinating facet. And another note to along the topic of theofascism, the responsibility of Christianity for this state of affairs must certainly be heavy. Without the initial Christian doctrines giving Europeans free rein over the rest of the world, much of the exploitation would not have occurred. It was only when people were able to combine Western greed with religious fanaticism that the type and extent of exploitation that history has recorded was made possible. Even today, the Christian missionaries search the jungles of the Amazon looking for Indian tribes to convert. And then, showing his, his sagacity, he points out a positive, positive side of the U.S. Which again, as the Tao advises, warns against absolutisms. In almost every generation, trade and conversion for religious purposes have gone hand in hand to destroy nations of the world on behalf of Western commercial interests and Christianity. Where the cross goes, there is never life more abundantly, only death, destruction, and ultimately betrayal. Among all the nations of the world, the United States has created the best record in dealing with Aboriginal peoples. The checks and balances of the American political system and the secular concern for justice have slowed the rate of exploitation of American Indians, so that for many tribes at least a portion of legal status exists. The United States, for example, is the only nation to establish a claims commission to attempt to rectify treaty wrongs with the native inhabitants. Canada refuses to discuss such a commission. Australia loathes the suggestion. So there he's showing the bright spot. And ironically, since much of the Constitution and the checks and balances and the legal system came from the Haudenosaunee, it's ironic that it's sort of like the conscience. There's still this conscience in America that, you know, as harsh as things are, there's an allowance, there's an opening. And as mentioned in the last book, in the last chapter, the last show about where are the Christian, you know, leaders speaking up against the violence if they're so Christian. Here he asks, why are not the true Christians demanding the resignations of the heads of American corporations supporting Amazon development? This was before the Amazon website. This, you know, again, talking about the commercial purposes and the colonization. And then a highlighted note here, it is this contemporary attitude toward original peoples that must be changed rather than compensation for past wrongs. For that, he says, being guilty for remote sins is easy. Accepting responsibilities for current and future sins is difficult. So again, it is this contemporary attitude toward Aboriginal peoples that must be changed rather than compensation for past wrongs. You know, again, highlighting the importance of such books and these discussions. If the attitudes can be changed, then things can really change, you know. I mean, Australia has a National Sorry Day. Okay, it's good to acknowledge and it helps something, but, you know, as Deloria highlights, the attitudes must change. And here he continues, we now recognize that the command of Genesis is not to be taken literally. We simply cannot continue to be fruitful and multiply without destroying everything. We need some relevant form of birth control. 2 decades ago, the legal status of abortion was changed, and for a brief time, we had some relief from the medieval conception of women as breeding stock. So, that's the view now, the capitalist view now is changing. Like, look at what capitalism is doing, has done, and why it needs to change. In recent years, Congress has considered forms of compensation for victims of violent crimes. This development is a return to old Anglo-Saxon law and finds its natural roots in the beliefs of tribal religions. The reward for suffering in Christianity has always been in heaven, and the idea that a society has a responsibility to compensate those whom it failed to protect has not been a major value of Christian nations. Such a societal conception has always dominated Indian tribal groups. Beyond that, however, the idea of social compensation means that we have taken a major step in the conceptualization of America as a society with a potential for integrity. It is perhaps the most important aspect of the problem. On almost every front, therefore, we find the old mythologies of Christianity being intellectually and often emotionally rejected by contemporary society. So again, another positive slant on, you know, what the U.S. or what this land, you know, the people here, the society now, that there are these openings, there is this opening to create a lot more positive change. We cannot reject the Christian religion piecemeal. The importance of the decline of the specific doctrines of the Christian religion is that this decline means that the whole religion has been misdirected from its inception. It arose out of a Near Eastern milieu in which control of populations was the important value, and its institutions it had continually sought to exercise control over the beliefs, values, and behaviors of large masses of people. And here I have a note how, again, along the lines of attitudes, how revisioning history affects where we are going and being here now. You know, when you look at the native people too, some not having, like, their view of time is that, you know, they're past, present, and future exist in the now. So to look at history from that view means that, you know, we can change things. And Deloria wraps up this chapter. We need to take a look at what the human experiences have been, and from our best conclusions begin to describe what we feel the whole nature of historical existence on the planet has meant. Stabilizing society so that further societal exploitation cannot exist is the first step in determining a new idea of history for humankind. The planet was not given to the Pope, and his subsequent division of it to his favorite European sovereigns may have ultimately been illegal in the most fundamental sense of the term. Present unhampered exploitation of the lands and peoples of the world by post-Christian supranational corporations may have been the logical result of Western history, but that does not have to be its final result. Christianity itself may find the strength to survive if it honestly faces the necessity to surrender its narrow interpretation of history and embark on a determined search for the true meaning of human life on this planet. Even surrendering a belief in God who exercises supremacy over world events becomes possible if, in surrendering the belief, one comes to greater understanding of the nature of religion and religious experiences. For a divinity, if indeed one exists, cannot even be bound in doctrines and beliefs in any ultimate sense. To restrict one's God, then, to a particular mode of operation and sequence of appearance would seem to be irreligious and the utmost folly. So again, trying to get a gist from a book as expansive as this is to look at the practicalities of the moment and how, you know, in native view of working with the land and every day noticing the changes in weather or whatever, we also need to take these institutional views of whether it's society, religion, humanity, environment, and put them to the practical test of what is actually happening. Chapter 16, Sacred Places and Moral Responsibility. When the tribes were forced from their aboriginal homelands and confined to small reservations, many of the tribal religious rituals were prohibited by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in the 1870s and 80s because of an inordinately large number of Christian zealots as Indian agents. So these things have improved. And here he talks about sort of the Supreme Court view of native ceremony. Most troubling about the Supreme Court's decision was the insistence on analyzing tribal religions within the same conceptual framework as Western organized religions. Justice O'Connor observed, a broad range of government activities, from social welfare programs to foreign aid to conservation projects, will always be considered essential to the spiritual well-being of some citizens, often on the basis of sincerely held religious beliefs. Others will find the very same activity deeply offensive and perhaps incompatible with their own search for spiritual fulfillment and with the tenets of their religion. Thus, ceremonies and rituals that had been performed for thousands of years were treated as if they were popular fads or simply matters of personal preference based upon the erroneous assumption that religion was only a matter of individual aesthetic choice. And that was touched on in previous shows, to see this religion or spiritual practice of the natives as not just an individual choice, not just an individual salvation, but in connection with the community and with the land. And here Deloria highlights that this lack of understanding highlights the great gulf that exists between traditional Western thinking about religion and the Indian perspective. It is the difference between individual conscience and commitment, Western, and communal tradition, Indian. These views can only be reconciled by examining them in a much broader historical and geographical context. Justice Brennan attempted to make this difference clear when he observed, although few tribal members actually made medicine at the most powerful sites, the entire tribe's welfare hinges on the success of individual practitioner. End quote. More than that, however, the, quote, world renewal ceremonies conducted by the tribes were done on behalf of the earth and all forms of life. To describe these ceremonies as if they were compatible to Oral Roberts seeking funds or Jimmy Swaggart begging forgiveness for his continuing sexual misconduct or Justice O'Connor's matters of community aesthetic preference is to miss the point entirely. In effect, the court declared that Indians cannot pray for the planet or for other people and other forms of life in the manner required by their religion. Two contradictory responses seem to characterize the non-Indians' attitude towards traditional tribal religions. Some people want the traditional healers to share their religious beliefs in the same manner that priests, rabbis, and ministers expound publicly the tenets of their denominations. Other people feel that Indian ceremonials are simply remnants of primitive life and should be abandoned. Neither perspective understands that Indian tribes are communities in ways that are fundamentally different from other American communities and organizations. Tribal communities are wholly defined by the family relationships. The non-Indian communities are defined primarily by residence, by an arbitrary establishment of political jurisdiction, or by agreement with generally applicable sets of intellectual beliefs. Ceremonial and ritual knowledge is possessed by everyone in the Indian community, although only a few people may actually be chosen to perform these acts. Authorization to perform ceremonies comes from higher spiritual powers and not by certification through an institution or any formal organization. And then he goes on to define the types of sacred lands. So, you know, we can get these phrases as, well, sacred land, you know, respect the land, but then, you know, to get from the people who know about that a lot, you get the different levels of it. I'll try to sum up the three here. The first and most familiar kind of sacred lands are places to which we attribute sanctity because the location is a site where, within our own history, something of great importance has taken place. And, you know, he cites sometimes, like, I guess, yeah, with the U.S., that could be like a violent, you know, the Gettysburg National Cemetery and things like that. There can be a sort of that view of it instead of the sort of more, you know, more nurturing view of it. Every society needs these kind of sacred places because they help to instill a sense of social cohesion in the people and remind them of the passage of generations that have brought them to the present. A society that cannot remember and honor its past is in peril of losing its soul. Indians, because of our considerably longer tenure on this continent, have many more sacred places than do non-Indians. Many different ceremonies can be and have been held at these locations. There is both an exclusivity and an inclusiveness depending upon the occasion and the ceremony. In this classification, the site is all important, but it is sanctified each time ceremonies are held and prayers offered. So that's one of those, like, so obvious things, I never thought about it. Because Indians have longer tenure on this continent, they have many more sacred places than do non-Indians. And then number two, a second category of sacred lands has a deeper, more profound sense of the sacred. It can be illustrated in Old Testament stories. Joshua, after the death of Moses, Joshua led the Hebrews across the River Jordan into the Holy Land, etc., etc. After crossing, Joshua selected one man from each of the 12 tribes and told him to find a large stone. The 12 stones were then placed together in a monument to mark the spot where the people had camped after having crossed the river successfully. When asked about this strange behavior, Joshua then replied, "This may be a sign among you that when your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, 'What mean ye by these stones?' then you shall answer them that the waters of Jordan were cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it passed over Jordan." So in this, it seems there's more of a sacred, what he calls sacred or higher powers have appeared. The sacred has become a part of the experience. This is sort of the memory of the sacred experiences that are, again, communal. And it's also a geographical thing. You know, he's hiding how each land, each tribe has, each different tribe, Apache, Ute, Comanche, Kiowa, Pueblo, Diné, Hopi, they each have their particular places. There is immense particularity in the sacred, and it is not a blanket category to be applied indiscriminately. Even east of the Mississippi, though many places have been nearly obliterated, people retain knowledge of these sacred sites. Their sacredness does not depend on human occupancy, but on the stories that describe the revelation that enabled human beings to experience the holiness there. Their sacredness does not depend on human occupancy, but on the stories that describe the revelation that enabled human beings to experience the holiness there. So, you know, the story can still convey the holiness. And this is reminded me of, I for many, many years had wondered why, say, you know, in suburbia, you see driving around, would see birds hanging out on wires, you know, as I was saying that, saw a bird fly by the fly by. But anyway, birds, hanging out on, say, outside of Kentucky Fried Chicken or what have you, and I, it just puzzled me, like, why would they do that, when they could hang, be on a tree. And then was reading, in Evan Pritchard's book Bird Medicine, he mentions that one of the explanations could be that, say, if a certain area, and say a crossroads or a high trafficked place in suburbia, could have been such a place for where natives held ceremonies, and for example, the crows would have gathered there, tuning into the ceremonial energy, and thus, long after that site is gone and paved over, the birds could still go to that site. So that was an eye-opening explanation. But I love how he emphasizes how the stories, carry the awareness, and I look at that in to the take it to the personal level, where in the backyard, here there was a lilac bush, and many years ago, the previous owner had ta you know even though I didn't want to see it, but the previous owner had took out the lilac bush for some reason. And so when I look over there, I can still be aware that there is a lilac bush, and sort of one of my signature haiku is this: must be good friends, three sparrows gathering on a lilac branch. So I carry that haiku with me, and the haiku conveys, regardless of the this place, it conveys that, it conveys that. But that's my little personal way of connecting with what, on a much wider scale, that is what Delore is talking about here, with it, and how we can look to greater respect the native peoples, and other who any peoples, and their sacred sites, by realizing that the energies are still there, and we need to be sensitive to that. And the third kind of sacred lands are places of overwhelming holiness, where the higher powers on their own initiative have revealed themselves to human beings. This is gets into, Moses in the bush. He's quoting, Moses was startled when the Lord spoke to him from the bush, warning, "Draw not hither, put off thy shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground." This phenomenon is worldwide, and all religions find that these places regenerate people and fill them with spiritual powers. Evidence of this moral responsibility that sacred places command has come through the testimony of traditional people when they have tried to explain to non-Indians at various times in this century, in court, in conferences, and in conversations, that they must perform certain ceremonies at specific times and places in order that the sun may continue to shine, the earth prosper, and the stars remain in the heavens. Tragically, this attitude is interpreted by non-Indians as indicative of the traditional leader's personal code or philosophy, and is not seen as a simple admission of a moral duty. It would be impossible for the thoughtless or impious acts of one species to have an immediate drastic effect on the earth. The cumulative effect of continuous secularity, however, poses a different kind of danger. Long-standing prophecies tell us of the impious people who would come here, defy the Creator, and cause the massive destruction of the planet. Many traditional people believe that we are now quite near that time. The cumulative evidence of global warming, acid rain, the disappearance of amphibians, overpopulation, and other products of civilized life certainly testify to the possibility of these prophecies being correct. Of all the traditional ceremonies extant and actively practiced at the time of contact with non-Indians, ceremonies derived from or related to these holy places have the highest retention rate because of their extraordinary planetary importance. Ironically, traditional people have been forced to hold these ceremonies under various forms of subterfuge and have been abused and imprisoned for doing them. Yet the ceremonies have very little to do with individual or tribal prosperity. Their underlying theme is one of gratitude expressed by human beings on behalf of all forms of life. They act to complete and renew the entire and complete cycle of life, ultimately including the whole cosmos present in its specific realization, so that in the last analysis, one might describe ceremonials as the cosmos becoming thankfully aware of itself. That's very, very beautiful. The ceremonies enable humans to have continuing relationships with higher spiritual powers, so that each bit of information is specific to the time, place, and circumstances of the people. No revelation can be regarded as universal because times and conditions change. The second and third kinds of sacred lands result from two distinctly different forms of sacred revelations, where the sacred is actively involved in secular human activities, and where the sacred takes the initiative to chart out a new historical course for humans. Because there are higher spiritual powers who can communicate with people, there has to be a fourth category of sacred lands. People must always be ready to experience new revelations at new locations. If this possibility did not exist, all deities and spirits would be dead. Consequently, we always look forward to the revelation of new sacred places and ceremonies. Unfortunately, some federal courts irrationally and arbitrarily circumscribe this universal aspect of religion by insisting that traditional religious practitioners restrict their identification of sacred locations to places that were historically visited by Indians, implying that, at least for the federal courts, God is dead. In denying the possibility of the continuing revelation of the sacred in our lives, federal court scholars and state and federal agencies refuse to accord credibility to the testimony of religious leaders. So, yeah, beautiful point there, how, you know, people will talk about sacred sites and, you know, you got to go to Egypt and, you know, you gotta go here and there. But, you know, where you stand is in essence a sacred site. And Deloria continues, we live in time and space and receive most of our signals about proper behavior from each other and the environment around us. Under these circumstances, the individual and the group must both have some kind of sanctity if we are to have a social order at all. By recognizing the various aspects of the sacredness of lands as we have described, we place ourselves in a realistic context in which the individual and the group can cultivate and enhance the sacred experience. Instead of denying this dimension of our emotional lives, we should be setting aside additional places that have transcendent meaning. I remember reading that, I think it was a bunch of the beats, like Snyder and Ginsberg, talking about having, like, what was, like, meditation booths or places, say you're traveling, and then, you know, now we think of, you know, you stop in to get a cup of coffee, maybe there's a site, you know, stop on the highway, and it's like a wildlife viewing point. So we have these sort of constructed places where we supposedly take a breather. But what if there were like these meditation booths and places like that that would encourage the regeneration of this spiritual energy? And a little bit more in this chapter, and the last chapter is kind of short. The nature of tribal religion brings contemporary America a new kind of legal problem. Religious freedom has existed as a matter of course in America only when religion has been conceived as a set of objective beliefs. This condition is actually not freedom at all, because it would be exceedingly difficult to read minds and determine what ideas were being entertained at the time. So far in American history, religious freedom has not involved the consecration and setting aside of lands for religious purposes, or allowing sincere but highly divergent behavior by individuals and groups. The issue of sacred lands, as we have seen, was successfully raised in the case of the Taos Pueblo people. Nevertheless, a great deal more remains to be done to guarantee Indian people the right to practice their own religion. The greatest number of Indian shrines are located in New Mexico, and here the tribal religions have remained comparatively strong. Cochiti Pueblo needs some 24,000 acres of land for access to and use of religious shrines in what is now Bandelier National Monument. The people also have shrines in the Tatilla Peak area. San Juan Pueblo has also been trying to get lands returned for religious purposes. Santa Clara Pueblo requested the Indian Claims Commission to set aside 30,000 acres of the lands that have religious and ceremonial importance to its people, but are presently in the hands of the National Forest Service and Atomic Energy Commission. In Arizona, the Hopi people have a number of shrines that are of vital importance to their religion. Traditionals regard the Black Mesa area as sacred, but it is being leased to Peabody Coal by the more assimilative tribal council. The San Francisco peaks within the Coconino National Forest are sacred because they are believed to be the homes of the Kachinas, who play a major part in the Hopi ceremonial system. And it goes on and on. And that's where they were making the snowball protests still happening, trying to use wastewater and making it into the sacred mountains into a tourist ski slope. Pipestone Quarry in southwestern Minnesota was confiscated from the Yankton Sioux. That's where they would make, you know, their sacred pipes, which again ties into the religious practices. And finally, there is the continuing struggle over the Black Hills of South Dakota. Many Americans are now aware of the state thanks to the success of the movie Dances with Wolves that not only depicted the culture of the Sioux Indians, but also filled the screen with the magnificent landscape of the northern Great Plains. 1991 was a year of great schizophrenia and strange anomalies in South Dakota. Local whites shamelessly capitalized on the success of the movie at the same time that they were frothing at the mouth over the continuing efforts of the Sioux people to get the federal lands in the Black Hills returned to them. Most non-Indians see in tribal religion the experiences and reverence that are missing in their own heritage. No matter how hard they try, they always reduce the teachings and ceremonies to a complicated word game and intellectual gestures. Lacking communities and extended families, they are unable to put the religion in practice. It might be sufficient to show that these patterns of behavior are indicative of a consistent attitude toward the world and includes the knowledge that everything is alive and related. Sacred places are the foundation of all other beliefs and practices because they represent the presence of the sacred in our lives. They properly inform us that we are not larger than nature and that we have responsibilities to the rest of the natural world that transcend our own personal desires and wishes. This lesson must be learned by each generation. Unfortunately, the technology of industrial society always leads us in the other direction. So hopefully, you know, now the technology is helping to bring us together, at least that the positive spin on the technology is enabling us to gather together more quickly. And he wraps up this chapter, yet it is certain that as we permanently foul our planet nest, we shall have to learn a most bitter lesson. There probably is not sufficient time for the non-Indian population to understand the meaning of sacred lands and incorporate the idea into their lives and practices. We can but hope that some protection can be afforded these sacred places before the world becomes wholly secular and is destroyed. So yeah, that seems there is some positive light going on nowadays, for sure. Now at this point, could extend this show to a part 7, but because the last chapter is not that long and because it continues the flow of what has already been said, I want to wrap up the series. So at this point, instead of a commercial break, you might want to pause the listening. It's up to you. And the final chapter, chapter 17, Religion Today. In preceding chapters, we have made tentative comparisons between Christian doctrines and beliefs and some of the beliefs of Indian tribal groups, which appear to stand in direct opposition. The opposition is more than conceptual. It colors the manner in which non-Indians view the world and the people they deal with in that world, particularly Indians. While many Christian doctrines have now passed into the sphere of Western civilization's general beliefs, others continue to form the basis of Christian belief and determine, in large measure, the manner in which Christians understand the world and form their responses to its events. Opposing tribal concepts to Christian concepts does not mean that tribal concepts are necessarily correct because Christianity is wrong. And it goes on and on. There's so much interesting here. The imminent and expected destruction of the life cycle of world ecology can be prevented by a radical shift in outlook from our present naive conception of this world as a testing ground of abstract morality to a more mature view of the universe as a comprehensive matrix of life forms. Making this shift in viewpoint is essentially religious, not economic or political. So again, he highlights that rather than these abstract beliefs and these sort of moral codes, the more mature view of the matrix of all life forms and what is actually happening, dealing with what is actually happening. Religious experiences are not nearly as important to Westerners as their creeds, theologies, and speculations, all products of the intellect and not necessarily based on experiences. Nathan Soderblom determined that monotheism was almost always a product of the political arrangement of a society and not the natural product of religious activities or experiences. When a religion is based in experience, whether it be theological or popular, it seems to be of a polytheistic or pantheon-oriented nature. Do not be absolutely certain that we are dealing with only one God. The fact that monotheism is logically pleasing does not mean that it is an accurate description of reality. The universe being somewhat discontinuous in other respects may also conceivably be discontinuous with respect to divinity. Wotan appears to have amazing resiliency. Yahweh's rainbow still shines in the sky. Ghosts prowl the British Isles. The picture of Jesus is appearing more frequently in unexpected places. And the Hopi have rain. And he highlights that the healing and divination powers can be another sort of litmus test of the religion. And here I have a note as the great disconnect. The impact of Christianity on the questions of time and space, however, was to transfer our real human and environmental problems to, quote, another world, end quote, thus sidestepping the question. The final result of this emphasis was to banish God from any possibility of relating to time and space, thus in effect precluding him from interference with this world. The major step to be taken to understand religion today is to understand the nature of religion as it occurs in specific places. There is a reason why shrines exist over and above the piety of the uneducated religious person who has visions while tending sheep. Mount Sinai, for example, has been a holy mountain for a considerable length of time, thus indicating it has a religious existence over and above any temporary belief held by particular people. If this concept is true, then economics cannot and should not be the sole determinant of land use. Unless the sacred places are discovered and protected and used as religious places, there is no possibility of a nation ever coming to grips with the land itself. Without this basic relationship, national psychic stability is impossible. So relating with the land, Mother Earth, all my relations, it's a religious, spiritual, holistic experience is what is needed, as accentuated by these words of Deloria. He's talking about how religions evolve, that religions change is a foregone conclusion. To go from Jesus on the hillside advocating the message of the Beatitudes to a cotton bowl filled with Jesus freaks chanting 2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits, $1, all those for Jesus stand up and holler, indicates that anything can occur in a religious tradition. Persistence of some religions on originally foreign lands would appear to testify to the fact that people and lands can relate to each other in a very powerful manner to develop a spiritual unity. It may be this possibility that will prove the salvation of Christianity in the modern world. Once having developed roots, as did the five nations at the great tree of peace at Onondaga, the land and the religion apparently became as one. The Hopi also established themselves on a land. Almost all of the healing disciplines came originally from religious beliefs and the religious leaders' practices. The severance of medicine and psychology from religion has only been a recent event in the histories of religious people. In the West, it has taken extreme forms, and the rising number of psychoanalysts coupled with the declining number of professional clergy testify to the fact that the religious crisis of Western civilization is taking extreme forms of alienation within itself. The phenomena of a substantial number of clergy suffering psychological problems indicates that religious and mental difficulties have not been solved by Christianity in any of its denominational expressions. Again, in the field of healing, relationships already seen as crucial to tribal religions are prerequisites for receiving healing powers. In none of the three areas, land, ethnicity, or healing, is any set of beliefs required in the traditional sense that Western thinkers have defined beliefs. The transition from traditional Western Christian categories to tribal and non-Western categories of religious experience is not then a matter of learning new facts about life, the world, human history, or adopting new symbols and garments. It is primarily a matter of participation in terms of the real factors of existence, living on the land, living with a specific community, and having religious people with special powers within that community. I remember hearing that when I was learning about the Lakota and the starting to train to protect themselves from the possible XL pipeline. And some of the techniques that we're learning were described as, locking arms and the way to prevent, possibly prevent people from getting on the land. And it was a good example of, yes, education is wonderful, but sometimes, the best thing to do is participation, and there's no time to sit there and learn stuff, but you must do something. And I'll wrap up this series with the last page and a half of the book. The analytical error of contemporary society is that they have not understood in religious terms the meaning of what they have already accomplished scientifically by revealing the world of sensory perceptions. In seeking an ultimate answer to the meaning of existence, that is, in reading God's mind, as early scientists described their work, modern society has foreclosed the possibility of experiencing life in favor of explaining it. Even in explaining the world, however, Western people have misunderstood it. We stand today at a series of crossroads. Rather than revolutionary movements, we may have possibly lapsed into a prolonged period of respectable boredom from which we will never recover. Clearly, the current tendency is to attempt to reclaim the 19th century roots of social existence that can give us a sense of permanency in a world of increasing change. But the stability of that era was at best a mythological memory of a golden age. Our very refusal to acknowledge the failures of both American and world history and our patriotic effort to make it into a golden age show how pathetic and inadequate our tools for confronting change really are. Within the traditional beliefs and customs of the American Indian people are the guidelines for society's future. It is this spirit of the continent of all continents that shines through the Indian anthologies and glimmers in the Indian communities in grotesque and tortured forms. The vision of stability of the community is found by non-Indians who venture into the reservation, and yet in viewing the remnants of Indian religion, they understand neither Indians nor themselves. White America and Western industrial societies have not heard the call of either the lands or the Aboriginal peoples. In the appalling indices of social disorder of the tribal peoples, Westerners see only continued disruption and, being unaccustomed to viewing life as a totality, cannot understand the persistence of the tribal peoples in preserving their communities, lands, and religions. The lands of the planet call to humankind for redemption. But it is a redemption of sanity, not a supernatural reclamation project at the end of history. The planet itself calls to the other living species for relief. Religion cannot be kept within the bounds of sermons and scriptures. It is a force in and of itself, and it calls for the integration of lands and peoples in harmonious unity. The lands wait for those who can discern their rhythms. The peculiar genius of each continent, each river valley, the rugged mountains, the placid lakes, all call for relief from the constant burden of exploitation. Who will find peace with the lands? The future of humankind lies waiting for those who will come to understand their lives and take up their responsibilities to all living things. Who will listen to the trees, the animals, and birds, the voices of the places of the land? As the long-forgotten peoples of the respective continents rise and begin to reclaim their ancient heritage, they will discover the meaning of the lands of their ancestors. That is when the invaders of the North American continent will finally discover that for this land, God is red. So, thanks so much for listening, and so much in the book that even the six-part series can't quite cover it all. And again, just if nothing else, there's the message of participate, connect with the land, connect with spirit where you are, starting now. It helps to learn things, but you don't have to sort of quote know anything. You just begin. So thanks for listening, have a good one. And we'll go out with a short piece by John DeBoer, DeBoer, off his CD Flute Songs for a Blue Moon. It's called Whispering White Dove.